Can you come out and play? Can you come out and play? Can you come out and play?
Hey, you're listening to Rock and or Roll, and on today's episode, I present to you an interview I conducted with Jonathan Paley, one half of the Paley brothers. Jonathan and his brother Andy. Jonathan and his brother Andy existed as a duo, as a group, for a few years there in the late 70s, but Jonathan bore witness to a lot of history over the course of the 70s, as you will hear on today's episode, from accidentally wandering into CBGB's with Jonathan Richman and discovering a band called Television on stage, to auditioning for the Heartbreakers with Johnny Thunders, Richard Hell, and Jerry Nolan, to recording with the Ramones and Brian Wilson, to being produced by Phil Spector, not to mention the story of the Paley brothers, who recorded a power pop classic for Sire Records in 1978 and were working on what could have been an amazing follow-up record that never came to be, but many of the songs that would have ended up on that second Paley Brothers album eventually came out on a CD called The Paley Brothers: The Complete Recordings in 2013. It's a great compilation and definitely worth checking out. After the Paley Brothers, Jonathan went on to join the Boston band The Nervous Eaters, whose demos were produced by Rick Ocasek, and he explains why Rick Ocasek did not end up producing the Nervous Eaters album that was released by Elektra Records. Anyways, I hope you enjoy this trip down memory lane with Jonathan Paley.
Can you come out?
The thing that happened with the Paley brothers, it was a combination of a lot of circumstances, but if we had gone on to make a second album, I think we probably would have had, you know, some success, certainly more success than we did with the first album.
How close were you to a second album? Because the songs on the CD that would have been for the second album are great, and it really seems like, yeah, it would have been a great record.
Well, I think, you know, in hindsight, of course, you know, I put a lot of responsibility for that not happening. But there were things going on, and in hindsight, I should realize, you know, I can do all this other stuff and do a Paley Brothers, do a second Paley Brothers album, which is what I should have done. I was doing other stuff. My brother was doing other stuff. And as, you know, time went by, you know, it wasn't like even really a conscious thing, because we were still working on stuff. So we were, you know, he was involved with other bands and other projects, and I was involved with other bands and other projects, and there was a certain level of I don't know how to put this, but I was, you know, I wanted to do something else. I wanted to do something different at that point, but, you know, but looking back at it now, it was I should have just realized, hey, I can do this and do all these other things. And of course, you know, it's 40 whatever years ago, so I was happy when we were able to actually get the stuff that wasn't released and put it out. There's actually a lot more. Yeah. We have more stuff that still hasn't seen the light of day, and I hope it will someday. But my brother's, he's very busy, and he's got all this stuff he's doing. You know, I'm not really in the music business anymore, but I'm hoping that we at some point will be able to do another release of other Paley Brothers stuff that hasn't been released previously.
So, like, one thing, it's, well, you guys were kind of ahead of the curve in terms of, there was this explosion more like 79 to 81 where, well, I guess I always thought part of it was because the Knack got so huge and the record labels just signed everybody. But it seems like power pop also came out of the punk scene. And obviously you guys were kind of connected to the punk scene. You were on Sire Records, and you played at CBGB's and stuff, right? What was your connection to the punk scene?
All right, so let me go back. I don't know, you know about the Sidewinders?
Yeah, I have that record, yeah.
Okay, so Andy was in the Sidewinders. That album came out, I think, in 71 or 72.
Yeah.
And prior to that, he was in Catfish Black, which was the, you know, the seeds of the Sidewinders, and he's been performing, you know, professionally since he was, you know, very young. I mean, you know, he started out as a drummer. He's one of the best drummers I've ever heard, still is. And he was also a songwriter. He's been a songwriter since he was a kid. He wrote a song when he was like 6 or 7 years old that was actually recorded by Tom Glaser. Came out on 78 in the 50s. But Andy's been writing songs for a long, long, long time. And he's been playing for a long time. He became one of the best frontmen you've ever seen. When he was fronting the Sidewinders, he was absolutely incredible. You know, so I grew up, you know, plus we had two older sisters that were record collectors when we were kids. I grew up, you know, this music and, you know, the AM radio and everything. And when I was about, I don't know, 10 or 11, actually younger even, like 9, I was watching a rerun of Ozzy and Harriet on TV. And Ricky Nelson and the band came on and played Traveling Man. I said to my mom and dad, I want a guitar for my birthday. And my birthday's in December. So being a child of December, your birthday present is often combined with your Christmas present. And sure enough, they got me a little 3/4 size nylon string guitar. And I got a book of chords and I started learning how to play, listening to like old records of my sisters. And when I was about 12 years old, we moved to Brooklyn, New York. Prior to that, we lived in a very, very small town in upstate New York. So we moved to Brooklyn. When I was maybe, 14, I'd been playing guitar for a while. I'd listened to all the oldies stations, all the old records. I knew all this music. I used to listen to the oldies. I forget what it was in New York City. But so this friend of mine told a friend of his, oh yeah, this guy, Kid Jonathan, you know, he can play okay. Because they were starting a band, and it was an oldies band. But these guys were all like in their like late 20s and maybe even early 30s, and they were actual honest to God greasers, you know, they were from like back in the day. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, now they're all like had jobs and some of them probably had kids and stuff. But they were getting this band together to do some gigs at this local bar, the Red Coach on 7th Avenue in Brooklyn. So they needed a bass player. I didn't own a bass, but my friend did. And he told them, he said, this kid can do it. So he lent me his bass, and I did probably, I don't know, maybe 10 gigs with these guys at this bar playing old doo-wop stuff and old, you know, Buddy Holly and some, you know, like Dion and the Belmonts. And these guys were like, yeah, how do you know all this stuff? I mean, you're just a kid. Well, you know, I listen to old music. I like old rock and roll and old stuff. So that was my first gig. And that band was called Dig It and the Doo-Wops. And then, you know, during this whole time, my brother was around that time. He started to do, you know, Catfish Black and then the Sidewinders. I was in high school when the Sidewinders got signed by RCA. And they put out that record, which was okay, but I mean, it wasn't representative of the band. They were one of the best live bands, you know, you've ever seen. I mean, they were in that whole scene with the Maxes and, you know, and up in Boston. And then when I graduated high school, Andy and I actually drove across country that summer from New York out to L.A. We spent the summer out in L.A. That's a whole nother long story, but it's just, a lot of stuff happened. So anyway, the whole way, you know, back and forth across the country, you know, we're singing a lot. We're going, you know, finding these radio stations. We're singing with each other, and we should do some stuff together. And I thought that'd be great. That'd be fantastic. So we get back to New York. I was starting college at Brooklyn College. Andy went back up to Boston. And what happened was there was a gig that Jonathan Richman was doing at the Kitchen. And this was like 1970, early 75, I guess. And Andy was playing with him, and they asked me to play with him as well. We did like, a, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 evenings there. And we were walking up, because this was down in Soho. We were walking up uptown, and we stumbled across CBGB's. I'd never heard of the place before.
Yeah.
And we went in, and Television was playing.
Wow.
And it was funny because Jonathan Richman, he stuffed napkins in his ears and was hanging out his ears. and was walking back and forth, like with his hands up, like you know, indicating that he was too loud and he didn't like the music. Anyway, I started talking to Richard Lloyd. You know, I said, yeah, I play guitar, you know, I'm starting the band. And at that point, actually, I was playing, I did like a couple of block parties and stuff with my friend Steve Warren, who's a bass player, and Billy Pappas, a guy, he played drums. And, you know, just doing oldies. And then I said to Steve, I said, you know, I really want, I want to do a band. I want to put a band together. Yeah, so I started playing. I did a couple of gigs just solo. Not at CBGB. I can't even remember the name. This one place in particular, it was like an auditorium. There was maybe like 20 people in the audience. And I just sang, you know, I sang some oldies, and that was it. And then I got this band together with Steve Warren and a guy named Barry Marshall, who's in a band called The Marshalls. Have you ever heard of The Marshalls?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know anything specific. Well,
you should look into them because they put out some records, and they were also very poppy, but also rock and roll.
Okay.
All brothers and sisters, actually. So Barry came down to New York. We rehearsed in the basement of my parents' house in Brooklyn, and then we started doing some gigs, opening for television, and some other bands. And I originally wanted to call the band Johnny and the T-Birds. And my brother was like, no, man. Even though he wasn't in the band, he was, you know, I because he was my older brother and I've been in the music business, I, you know, of course, took everything he said, you know, very seriously.
Yeah.
And he said, call the band Mon. I said, what? Call it Mon. And what the hell is that? You know, M-O-N-G, Mon. So I was like, okay. So we called ourselves Mon, which was like probably the worst band name in the history of music. and we did for about, you know, several months. We were playing gigs all over New York, CBGBs, Max's, Zeps, Mothers, 82, opening for everybody. And it was during this time when everybody would hang around at all these bars. So Johnny Thunders says, hey, we're looking for a guitar player. I want you to come down and see if it works out. So it's like, okay. So I go down to the rehearsal space and learn their songs. It was Richard, Richard Hell. It was Richard Hell, Johnny Thunders, Jerry Nolan. And I learned, Pirate Love and Hurt Me and Blank Generation. And in fact, we were doing Blank Generation at
wow.
rehearsal, and Richard goes, hey, John, do you think any background vocals you could do? And, I said, well, I don't know. And I'm just like, so going, so he would never acknowledge it, but I'm the one that came up with that at one of the rehearsals.
Wow.
So we rehearsed, and then he said, hey, come back like the day after tomorrow. We're going to have another rehearsal. Okay. So I come back again, and as I was walking in, who comes walking out but carrying a guitar case? Chris Stein,
yeah.
All dressed up, wearing these like platform boots. So he had been rehearsing with them too.
Mm.
So we rehearsed again. Johnny liked the way I play guitar. He was like, "Man, how do you do that? Do some more of that." I was playing a Harmony Meteor. Great guitar. I wish I still had that guitar. Hollow body, single cutaway with these just like the most powerful fucking pickups. You just put your finger anywhere on the neck and get instant feedback. It's just a great guitar with a Bigsby on it. So I go back for a third time, third rehearsal. And while we're rehearsing, Bob Gruen comes to the door. And he starts taking some pictures and he goes, hey, man, let's go out on the fire escape. So Bob goes out on the fire escape. Richard goes out. Johnny goes out. I'm putting my foot up on the radiator to go out through the window. And Jerry Nolan grabs me by the shoulder from behind, pulls me back. He says, no, not you. So they go out there. And that's that famous picture where they're on the fire escape, where it's Richard Hell, Johnny Thunders, and Jerry Nolan all on the fire escape. And I'm on the inside. I'm back inside watching them. do this. I was like, okay, I didn't figure what's going on. So then I get a call from Richard, a day later or something. He's like, you know, this isn't going to work. You know, Jerry, I said, what's going on? You know, why not? He says, Jerry doesn't want you in the band. I was like, why? He says, I don't know. He says, he doesn't want you in the band. So they had their first gig. It was shortly thereafter at Canterbury in Queens. And I went down there because I was still hoping to be in the band. And they did the gig as a trio. And, you know, I figured, okay, well, after that, I'm not going to be in the band. So I went back to doing Mon. And I actually opened for them a couple of times as Mon. And then, you know, Walter joined the band. And Walter was a really nice guy. I loved Walter. Just passed away recently.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, because of that band, I mean, I knew all those people, and I'd opened for most of them, and I, you know, it was everybody, all the same people would hang out at the same clubs every night. It was, you know, I mean, not the same clubs. I mean, you go from club to club to club, but it was all the same people. And so around this time, the Sidewinders broke up in probably 73, maybe early 74. So Andy and I, you know, we started doing, the reason we were also at the Kitchen was because Arthur Russell, you know who Arthur Russell is?
Rings a bell, but...
Arthur Russell is a very famous kind of quirky singer-songwriter who has a huge, huge cult following.
Okay.
Anyway, he was running the Kitchen. He was running the Kitchen, and he had a TAC 4-track, and Andy met him, I guess he met him through Jonathan Richmond, and so we started recording demos there. And it was a beautiful room. It was just this huge loft, so it had a wonderful natural echo. And we recorded a bunch of demos there, and then we also did some up in Boston. And we started sending them around. And we got some, you know, there was some interest here and there. And then somehow we got it to Seymour at Sire. And Seymour loved our stuff. And he came to see us up in Boston. So he signed us. And you know, we were very, very different from most of what was getting signed at that time. This was before the Talking Heads. It was, you know, it was just after the Ramones. But in a way, they were very, to me, the Ramones are power pop. They're very power pop.
Yeah.
You know, Sheena is a punk. I mean, Rockaway Beach, is, you know, it's a power pop song. And Joey was just an encyclopedia of old music. I mean, he knew every old record, everything about it, you know.
Yeah.
Who sang it, who produced it, you know, where it was done, what label came out, and how high it went on the charts. And he knew every word to all the lyrics. And he loved all that old stuff. He once told me after Rock and Roll High School, because we did that, you know, we did that thing with the Ramones, because, you know, Joey was in the hospital when they were out in LA and we were recording the Paley Brothers album. And Seymour came up with the idea of doing Come On, Let's Go. And it was Dee Dee, Tommy, and Johnny at Brother Studio with us, and we did that, you know, that version, which is one of my favorite records that I ever did. Later on, I was talking with Joey. He goes, you know that I can't do his voice, but you know, he said that cut was his favorite cut on the record. I don't know if he was just being nice to me or whatever, but it meant a lot to me. And yeah, I love that record. So as far as the punk connection with power pop, you know, once again, these are broad terms. I mean, you know, in 1975, nobody was calling it punk rock. So, you know, that's my connection with this, with so-called punk. I mean, it went on from there. I mean, the Nervous Eaters, I did, you know, two albums with the Nervous Eaters, played with them longer than the Paley Brothers existed, actually. We we toured with everybody that was around and opened for everybody that came through the Northeast. And I played with a bunch of other people. And there's a whole connection with Jonathan Richmond and Patti Smith. And, you know, my brother worked a lot with both of them. And I worked a little with both of them. You know, Andy became a producer. And he's produced everybody from Little Richard and Brenda Lee and Jerry Lee Lewis and Brian Wilson, up through, people like the Bluebells or Richard X. Heyman or what's his name? John Wesley Harding.
Yeah. He produced Greenberry Woods, right? I love that.
Greenberry Woods, yeah. Yep. He worked with everybody, I was lucky enough to be included in some of it. But I really left the business for, this is 1986. I, through a weird set of circumstances, I ended up leaving the country and spending the next 4 years crewing on sailboats all over the world. Came back to America in late 1990. And at that point, Andy was like a staff producer at Warner Brothers. And I would come in and work with him when he wanted me to. And then it was funny, I ran into an old guy that I knew, a friend from Boston who was out here in L.A. And we played together for a little while and did some recording. And because of that, I kind of met up with some other people. And now and then I would do some recording, a little bit of producing. Nothing ever really went anywhere. And then I was also, for a year or two, doing, I was like the low-level A&R guy at Sire. Seymour hired me back. And I got one band signed. Ended up coming out on Egg Records. Didn't really go anywhere. I was Skirt. And since then, I've been doing a lot of other things. I mean, right now I work as a set medic. I became an emergency medical technician and a nurse. I worked in emergency rooms for 15 years. And got into this set medic thing where I work on TV and movies. And that's where I am right now, actually. I'm sitting in the medic office on a soundstage in Santa Clarita a cable TV show. Now, getting back to Power Pop, what else do you want to know?
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about was Earl Mankey, because I'm a huge fan of a number of records that he produced around that time, like The Pop and 2020 and The 3 O'Clock. And it seems like he was an amazing producer, but all of the records he did sound different. They sound great in similar ways, but they're all very different. So I wonder what it was like with Earl.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Earl, because Earl, I recorded my daughter's record, Ballad of a Teenage Queen, with Earl at Earl's studio, which is in Thousand Oaks. Now, Earl is great. He's a wonderful engineer and is a great producer. The problem that we had with the Paley brothers was that I think that we needed somebody that was going to be more in charge, that would have said, no, this is the way it's going to be, and had a more objective viewpoint, because we needed somebody at that time to kind of, tell us what to do. For the large part, it's my brother's music. My brother, is very talented. And he's very driven. And I think that he, was unable to kind of like step away and step back and take a look at things from an objective point of view, especially at that time. Because he had very, very definite ideas about what he wanted to do. And I think Earl was very accommodating. Earl's such a nice guy. He's so laid back. So it was kind of, I think that combination, plus with my naivety at the time, because I had the only experience I had, was what I had done, as far as recording was, with my brother doing demos. And my only experience on stage had been with, at that point, Mong and, the oldies band that I had played in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. So Earl, I think Earl, I don't know, I'd have to ask him, but I imagine he would probably say, I should have taken a little more control, or maybe I should or maybe, you know, it should have been done this way or that way. But I love Earl. You know, we worked with Phil Spector as well. We did a recording with him.
Yeah.
You know, which turned out to be great, but doing it was torturous for me.
Yeah.
That contributed in some way to me deciding that, you know, I wanted to move on from the Paley Brothers. Although, you know, it's like I said, in hindsight, that was a stupid decision. I should have just said, okay, well, I'll do this, but I'll also do these other things. But, you know, Phil was, you know, we spent over 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, going over to his house every day and, you know, standing next to his Lowry organ while he sat there and played the same song over and over and over and over and over and over.
Was there a gun involved?
No, not at all. You know, okay. And I know he's, I absolutely believe that he killed that woman, but I don't believe it was murder. I think he was playing with his gun like he's done for 50 something years.
Right.
And finally one of them went off.
Right.
You know, which is bound to happen when you play with a gun.
Yeah.
And you're drinking.
Yeah.
You know, that's the other thing with Phil, is that when he's sober, he was the nicest, sweetest, funniest, smartest guy, talented guy, but two glasses of wine and it was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Right.
He was just—he would become this abusive, horrible, nasty little prick.
Oh God!
And it was totally, totally the alcohol. That's, you know, and it's really sad.
Yeah.
Really, really sad.
Yeah.
Because when he's sober, just a wonderful, wonderful guy, and incredibly talented.
Baby, I can't let you go. Sad and blue, you know I'll make it up to you. 'Cause we've been through way worse than this. We could make up with one kiss. And you know that's all we'd have to do. So come on, baby, baby, let's stick together. Baby, let's stick together. We've been through way worse than this. And we could make up with one kiss. Baby, let's stick together. Baby, let's stick together. I just can't make it on my own. Baby, don't walk out that door. We'll both regret it, that's for sure. I wanna make you change your mind. To give me your heart, you got mine.
There's a lot of stuff that my brother recorded with Brian Wilson, which I don't know if it'll ever see the light of day. Some of it you can find online. It's like bootleg. But, you know, Brian, the stuff that he did with my brother is some of it is like the best stuff he's done since Pet Sounds.
Every morning I wake up with that same sad feeling. It's killing.
They had a great relationship working together, and you know, it kind of, I don't know the exact circumstances of why it's not ongoing, but I think it, you know, it has something to do with Brian's wife and just having, you know, someone having steering where what, you know, what's going on with Brian's career and his music and everything, which is kind of what Brian has always had. You know, anything outside of the creative process or the recording process, he has always pretty much had somebody else in charge. First it was his father, then it was his wife, then it was Dr. Landy, and now it's his new wife. That's kind of how he's lived, which is, you know, that's his life. And he's, you know, when he's in the studio and when he's writing songs, it's, he's in control. I think when it comes to business decisions or, you know, anything that has to do with, you know, that involves money or, you know, planning a tour or, you know, that kind of thing, I think he cedes control to somebody else. I mean, yeah, and Mike Love, I think, you know, for a long time also had a lot to say about what was going on. But when Andy and he were together, you know, it was great. I got to work on a lot of that stuff, and it was so much fun.
Yeah.
And he was, and he, you know, both of them together in the studio, you know, just getting stuff off each other, you know, and it was, I felt very, very honored to be able to be involved in some of that. And hopefully it'll see the light of day someday.
Yeah. So were you happy with how the Paley's record turned out, how it sounded?
No. No, I was. I mean, some of it I was, some of it I wasn't. There were aspects of certain things that I was. I mean, my vocals, I'm not happy with on a lot of the stuff. Because I wasn't really, you know. See, the thing with, like, Andy had been in the business for a while, and he was a writer, and he was a performer, as a front man. I mean, he was just a terrific front man and communicator. I could sing, technically, but I could not perform like Andy could. And I you know, I listen to those, that especially that record now, some of the songs, like Tell Me Tonight, which is a great song, but I, you know, it's like I didn't know how to put more into it. I didn't know how to deliver, I guess, the emotion, really. And I think a lot of my singing on the record is, I don't know how to describe it. It's not stiff. It's not flat. It's almost like they're just not, like, I'm not conveying emotion, which was something that I didn't learn for a long time. And by the time I had, it's kind of like, well, now I'm not a vocalist anymore. I mean, that's the major thing about the record that really bugs me. Like, you know, I listen to it now, it's not so bad, but it's just, I think, yeah, I could have done so much better. I could have been so much better on that record. It was inexperienced to a large degree. And I think if we had continued on, it would have gotten better. I mean, those later recordings are better. To me, like Meet the Invisible Man and Boomerang, you know, are great recordings and probably, you know, would have done something.
Meet the Invisible Man.
There's some great playing on the Paley Brothers album. I mean, some of the stuff that Eric Rose did was just really good. Some of the songs, the drum sound is great. Some of them I'm not so happy with. It's not like you ever expect to make a perfect record. You know, especially being the person who's on that record, it's hard for me to say, I'm happy with this record. And yeah. It's happened to me other times. I mean, the first Nervous Years album that we did was, you know, not very good. I don't know if you're familiar with that record. The
It's got bites out of the cover,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yes. It's not representative of the band at all. The demos that we did for that record were 100 times better than that record. And that's a whole another story because it was, you know, Rick Ocasek produced the demos and he was supposed to produce the record. They're managed, you know, the Cars were managed by this guy, Fred Lewis, who also at that time was managing us, the Nervous Eater. And then the Cars wanted to get rid of Fred. And they had a big legal battle with him and they got rid of him. And because of that, we couldn't have Rick produce the record. So we ended up with Harry Maslin. And Harry's a great guy and a good producer, but he had no idea what the Nervous Eaters were about.
Yeah.
And consequently, and plus at that time, Steve Cataldo, who was the Nervous Eaters, he was the guy. I think he was very intimidated by the whole thing and was also trying to, I think he felt like he didn't want to really be like the Nervous Eaters were because he wanted to sell records. He wanted to be more mainstream, but he didn't realize that if he had done the record like we did the demos, it probably would have been a huge record. And I went through that with that, you know, that album. And then later on, we made a good record with, you know, Ace of Hearts, but that was, you know, years later. You know, I've done records. I mean, a lot of the records I've been involved in, I produced the first couple Shrapnel records and they were okay, but, you know, I mean, and listen to them now, it's like, yeah, that's pretty good. But I mean, even at the time, I was like, I was not completely happy with them.
Shrapnel.
Same thing with the Dogmatics. I did, excuse me?
Shrapnel with Dave Windorf, the New Jersey band?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you produce that EP?
I produced Combat Love, oh. Big Free Line. I'm not sure if those are on there. The EP came out after that, after those two singles.
Oh, there's this, one of my favorite songs ever is Master of My Destiny.
That's not me.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the great songwriting teams that you'll see in the songwriting credits, Windorf Rabinowitz. it rolls off the tongue.
What was it like watching Dave Windorf become Monster Magnet? Was that?
Well, you know what? After Shrapnel, I just kind of like, you know, I lost touch. I saw Danny Rabinowitz, then called himself Danny Ray.
Yeah.
Later on, when he was a musical director for Ronnie Spector, and he, you know, toured with her. But I haven't seen Windorf since, probably 1980.
Right.
Like it's been a long time, but I saw a picture of him recently. You know, he's got the age, but we all have.
I have
and
that.
I never really listened to Monster Magnet, so I don't even know. I guess they're kind of, what are they, like a heavy metal band?
Yeah, like stoner rock, you know, like really.
I don't know.
I have that. I have a record called the Dirt Records compilation. I think Combat Love is on there.
Yeah, well, that's me. You know, it's, and you know, Legs was their manager at the time, and when he said, "Hey, John, I want you to produce this," I was like, "Great!" I said, "But listen, you've got to put my name. The most important thing for me is that it says produced by Jonathan Paley on the label." So of course, the record comes down, it doesn't say produced by anybody, and then when the sleeve comes out, it says produced by Jonathan Paley and Legs McNeil. So I was, you know, I mean, I love Legs. I actually worked with Legs recently, but you know, that was like, God damn it, Legs. <You know? laughs> But yeah, so yeah, I also produced a couple of songs by the Dogmatics, Fair Street, and Sure Don't Feel Like Christmas Time. I did Band 19, a Richie Parsons band. What else? Oh, well, Skirt, and you know, I played with a bunch of different people back, you know, back then, before I got on that boat and took off in 86. Kids, we were little kids. We lived in this very, very small town, less than 100 people. One road, one gas station, one stop sign, two churches. That was it. Surrounded by dairy farms. And we would listen to WTRY and WPTR up in upstate New York. Back then, AM radio played everything. They played everything. They played Perry Como, but they'd play the Kinks. You know, they'd play Frank Sinatra, and they'd play the Rolling Stones, you know, on the same station. And like I said, we had two older sisters who, you know, had been collecting records since the mid-50s. And, you know, and then he did his thing with this, with the Catfish Black and the Sidewinders. And if you listen to that Sidewinders album, the song Rendezvous, which is on that record, it's also on the one of the Paley Brothers. It was on one of the EPs, but also on compilation. You know, that was, he wrote that, I think when he wrote that, he had like Be My Baby in mind or something like that. So, but then at the same time, like, we covered, we did Tell Me Tonight, which was really like an attempt at a disco record almost. And then you had Down the Line, you know, Buddy Holly cover, which was like, you know, kind of Yard Beardian in a way. And we I heard the Bluebirds Sing, which was, you know, very, very almost, bluegrassy. I met a girl out in the hills.
thrills, gave my lonely heart a thrill. Her beauty seemed just like a breath of spring. And when I looked into her eyes, I thought of bluest summer skies. When I held her hand in mine, I heard the bluebirds sing. They sang of wondering,
wondering if he loves her.
Will she marry?
Marry if he asks her.
Will her heart be?
Heart be true for him, for?
For him forevermore. And when she's lonely,
lonely is he near her.
When there's sadness,
sadness will he cheer her.
Will they always,
always be together?
Until in death they part. I courted her for months on end until she promised we would wed. We planned on being married in the spring. All through the long cold winter months, it seemed like spring would never come. And every gloomy winter day, I heard the bluebirds sing. They sang of waiting,
waiting for the flowers,
and of counting,
counting every hour,
till the bluebird,
bluebird chirps his welcome into the world once more.
Well, it wasn't like we were specifically aiming at, you know, bubblegum, or aiming at country pop, or aiming at, you know, R&B, but I think there are elements of all of those things on that album and in the and on the EPs and the singles that we did. So it's you can't really, I mean, you know, like Come Out and Play is almost like a Four Seasons type, you know, thing going on there, although not lyrically so much, but, you know, with the, if you listen to that, which was produced by Jimmy Iovine, by the way, and that was Jimmy, the stuff that Jimmy Iovine did with the Paley Brothers was the first production credit that Jimmy Iovine ever had. Prior to that, he was strictly an engineer.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't say that we were aiming, or Andy was aiming, to make a bubblegum record, but I would have been very happy at, you know, to have a successful bubblegum record, and I would have been very happy to have a successful power pop record. I'd been very happy to have a successful record of any kind.
Yeah. You seem to be set up for success in a lot of ways.
This is something that I hear so many times. I've heard this so many times. The Paley Brothers had to work really hard not to make it.
Uh-huh.
Like, we had everything going for us, and we still didn't hit it big. And in a way, you know, we had a lot going for us. We had Andy's talent. We were both very good-looking young men. Andy was a great performer. We did have a lot going for us, and we had the backing of a record company. You know, they really tried hard. You know, it's a combination of a lot of things, but, you know, it's the old thing. You know, if I knew then what I knew now,
yeah,
you know, it would have been very different. But, you know, that's history.
Well,
that's history.
Well, you know, when I first got the complete recording CD, and I heard songs like Meet the Invisible Man and Running in the Rain, I was blown away.
I want
So those are very, like, those feel like recordings you could have put out on a record. Like, were you actually recording for a second record? Those aren't demos, right?
No, they were, you know, they were recordings that we had started, and then, you know, Andy finished them up.
Okay.
And they sat, you know, they sat for, I don't know how many years. And then, you know, when we were first approached to do that compilation CD, Andy did not want to do it. Yeah. He was busy with other stuff. And I said, look, Andy, come on, man. It's time, all that stuff that we never put out, and, you know, the live stuff and everything. Come on, man. So he reluctantly agreed to it. But then once he started going through the old stuff, he had to, you know, search around for a lot of this stuff. He got very, very into it. And there's a lot of remixing and a lot of that stuff, which is fine. You know,
right.
Okay.
Right.
No, especially Meet the Invisible Man and Boomerang to me, you know, just, yeah, I think they could have been hit records, especially Boomerang. Almost Tommy James and the Shondells revisited type thing. Meet the Invisible Man is probably my favorite Paley Brothers recording. It's long, but I love that it's long. I think it's 6 minutes long.
Yeah, it's not at all what I was expecting, you know.
Yeah. And the Spectre track, you know, to me, it's great as a document, as, you know, I mean. But I mean, it's not the greatest record Phil Spector ever did by any stretch of the imagination, you know. But Running in the Rain. There's different versions. There's a whole different version of Running in the Rain. It's a whole different version of Sapphire Eyes. You know, with me singing lead on Sapphire Eyes, which is almost entirely in falsetto, and I really like it. But Andy preferred the one that he sang, which is also really good. But there's a lot more stuff. The demos and unfinished recordings that I'm hoping that we can get to. Andy's still very busy, and to convince him to do another compilation will probably take a lot of work. But I'm gonna when he has time, hopefully we'll be able to revive some of that other stuff.
How close were you to having a second album with Sire? Was it close?
We probably could have done it at any time, but I bear a large responsibility for this not happening, because what happened was I came home from doing that Spectre session, and Steve Cataldo from the Nervous Eaters said, "Hey, Jonathan, yeah, we want you to join the band. You know, we're going to be doing a record soon and everything." And, you know, so I was like, okay, great. Because at that time, you know, the Paley Brothers, you know, after we did the first record, we did, you know, a little bit of touring, not much, but we opened for Sean Cassidy, you know, Madison Square Garden and Toronto Stadium and all these hockey arenas, like big places. And our rhythm section was the Nervous Eaters. Andy and I went out to record with Spectre. We did that. And then, you know, the Eaters had, you know, they were getting signed to Elektra, and Andy was also, he was on the road with Patti Smith, and he was on the road with Jonathan Richmond. So I said, well, I'm going to go on the road with the Nervous Eaters. I'm going to go record with them out in LA. So the Paley Brothers whole thing, you know, it kind of languished there. You know, like I said, in hindsight, what I should have done was, okay, let's do this Nervous Eaters thing. Hey, Andy, let's finish the Paley Brothers record. Seymour, put this out. But everybody, you know, all the parties involved in all these different sides and aspects of this we're doing so much, doing so many other things that it just kind of like fell by the wayside.
Yeah.
And Andy, you know, Andy had a lot going on and I had stuff going on too. So it was Andy, you know, Andy was, you know, I mean, he was so involved when he would get into another project. It was like, that was like the driving thing that he was into then. So he was, if he was working with Jonathan Richmond, that's what he was concentrating on. If he was working with Patti Smith, that's what he was concentrating on. He wasn't going to, it wasn't like, let's go back and finish the Paley Brothers album. And because he was, you know, having success at what he was doing, that was another, it wasn't like he was not looking to finish the Paley Brothers album, but he had too much else going on to do that.
Yeah.
And by the time that I, had gone up and down with the Nervous Eaters, I don't know. It's just that, at that point in my life, 1985, 86, I was like, I don't know, man. You know, this is, I was not real happy with what I was doing. And this opportunity was just kind of came up out of nowhere to get on this boat. I was supposed to be gone for a few months and it ended up turning into 4 years. And it was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. But that really kind of like changed a lot of things for me.
Yeah.
And when I came back to the United States, the last boat I was on ended up at Marina Del Rey in Los Angeles. And I was walking around, you know, I'd been in the tropics for 4 years, lifting anchors and hauling sails. And, you know, I was like this, you know, just in incredible condition, and I have long blonde hair and it's, you know, tan, and I'm walking around and somebody says, "Hey, aren't you the guy from that show?" And I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about? You're the actor from that show, right?" It's like, no, you're not an actor. You know, well, you should be. I keep talking to him. He's like, "Yeah, you should go to, you know, you should like, you know, you could like, you know, go to this place and that place, and they'll put you in the movies." I was like, "Really?" I didn't know anything about the movie business. So it was like Forrest Gump. I went down to Central Casting, and I ended up working as an extra and a stand-in and a body double, and once in a while as an actor for the next 10 years. That's what I did. And then through another weird set of circumstances, I ended up becoming an EMT. And then I became a nurse. And then I became a set medic. Yeah. So life takes you different places. You know?
Yeah, I always wonder, with someone like you who was around Andy Warhol and Phil Spector and just around all this, like, history. Like, you talk about, oh, I played a gig with Jonathan Richmond, and then I walked down the street and saw television, you know? And, like, are you ever just in line at the grocery store or something, and you're just like, none of these people know.
Stop right there. So I've come back to Los Angeles. It's about it's the early 90s. And I was staying with my brother in Los Feliz. So I go to this grocery store to pick up some groceries. And I'm standing in line behind this guy, and he's got a cast on his foot. And he turns to the side and says, "Holy shit, it's Billy Ficca, drummer for Television," who I hadn't seen in, you know, I don't know, since like the 70s.
Yeah.
I was like, "Billy!" He looks at me and he goes, "Oh my God," because I looked a lot different. I mean, you know, in 1975, I weighed about 135 pounds, and I was like, you know, smoking a pack of cigarettes and snorting Coke every day. And so I was a lot healthier. And is what anybody recognized? He's like, "Holy shit. Yeah, but no, I know what you're talking about." It's funny because I worked on these sets. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I was working on this show, and I went by the wardrobe trailer, and the guy's like steaming this T-shirt. And it's a Velvet Underground T-shirt. It's for one of the actors to wear, on the show. And I was like, "Oh man, who came up with that? You know, God, that's really trendy, the Velvet Underground. Wow." And the guy got all offended. And I was like, "Oh, yeah, you know, let me say something." So I pull out my phone, and I pull out this picture of me with a bunch of other people, with John Cale. I said, you know who any of these people are?" He's like, "No." And I said, "Well, that's John Cale from the Velvet Underground. That's Patti Smith. That's David Johansen from the New York Dolls. That's Dee Dee Ramone from the Ramones. And that's me."
Right. Yeah.
Okay. okay.
Yeah. You know?
Thank you. All right, you guys are great. All right, I'm going to play guitar on this next one. Thank you. Hey, Jonathan, get back up here. Come on up.
Hey, thank you.
Going to do one called Felicia. Here we go.
There goes Felicia with a walk so light. Ooh, Felicia with a dress so tight. Look at gal, she thrills me so. I'd be a fool to ever let it go. Oh, honey, you kiss her pie. Thrills I get up and down my spine. She even loves me when we're on the ice. And as my friends as to my whereabouts. Ooh, Felicia, why are you so nice? I can't wait. Oh, honey, you make me feel good. Even better than I thought you would.
That's right!
Yeah.